All so simple, even though pops was not around and mama had to struggle. Surviving in the ghetto, we hustle, that's universal. Like an international plague, I hit us in the middle of the body. My community's been torn apart. I was told if you want to change, you gotta start with the heart. Then you see clear both sides, light and dark. Time to make a decision, speed up or slow it down. We gotta find a solution before my people go down and never come back up. Are you ready to wake up? Remember how far we come and we could do it again. This is that fist up and one love.
We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Hisham Aidi, who is a lecturer in the discipline of international and public affairs at Columbia University. He's a Carnegie Scholar, Global Fellow at the Open Society Foundation. And his book is Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. And Hisham, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you, Mark.
Hisham, this is, you know, for a long time I've had conversations on the air about the power of hip hop as the music of rebellion and revolution across the globe, especially in the Islamic world and the Muslim world and the Arab world, and also the Native American world and other kind of indigenous cultures that are kind of grabbing a hold. And we can get to that point, but what was interesting to me is going through your book is that the complexity is much more historically complex than that. I mean, I never thought about it in terms of the connection to Muslim slaves coming to this hemisphere and Brazil. And there's a complexity here that I think you're developing a historical analysis that I never thought about ever existing.
Yeah, I mean, I begin with the Muslim slaves who were brought to the Americas in the 1500s. And I actually begin in Brazil. I begin the book in Brazil with the great uprising of 1835, the so-called Malé Uprising, a slave revolt that took place in Salvador da Bahia up in northeast Brazil. And the uprising failed, but its historical resonance is quite extraordinary, right? I mean, even back then, it would resonate across the Atlantic. You know, newspapers in France and Britain would talk about, is this a jihad we have in the South Atlantic? What is this about, you know, these Muslim slaves, and so on. But what's interesting to me is that the history of Muslim slaves that were brought to the Americas after 1492 is today being revisited by the younger Muslim generation, and it's inspiring all kinds of movements, right? So I begin in Brazil because I was doing research in Brazil last year and a few years ago, and I came across a hip-hop collective outside of Sao Paulo called Posse Hausa. And Posse Hausa, they're Muslim. The head of the organization is a gentleman by the name Honore El Amin. There's another gentleman there by the name of Ali Jamal Shabazz. What they're doing is they're trying to create a black Muslim identity for Afro-Brazilians, and they are inspired by American hip-hop, right? What Honore El Amin told me, he said, you know, I got my political education through American hip-hop, particularly 1990s hip-hop. The early 1990s hip-hop that was Afrocentrist and political. And he says, through hip-hop, I learned about Malcolm. I read Malcolm X's autobiography. And through that, I became aware of the history of the Malays, their literacy, their cultural achievements, their organization, and so on. And we're trying to recuperate that history. It's a process of historical recovery reminiscent of the rise of Islam among African-American communities in the early 20th century, when you have this process of historical recovery movements such as the Moore Science Temple and Nation of Islam that would try to recuperate the history that was beaten out of the history and Islam that was beaten out of African slaves brought to the Americas. And so I talk about the role that hip-hop plays in Afro-Brazilian politics and how, you know, Honore El Amin tells me in Brazil, hip-hop is a moral advantage over funk, right? And it's an interesting statement because the hegemonic music of Brazil for decades has long been samba and to a certain extent bossa nova. The government has mobilized samba, portrayed samba as the sound of the nation, depicting, sort of capturing the racial harmony and racial democracy of Brazil. And with the transition to democracy in the late 80s in Brazil, you begin to get other alternative movements, musical movements. So on the one hand, you get funk that emerges in Rio, and on the other hand, you get hip-hop emerging in Sao Paulo. And, you know, the funk is sort of criticized for its excesses, consumerism, violent lyrics, and so on, whereas hip-hop is more political. And what the gentleman at Posse House, or the activist at Posse House, told me is that it's no coincidence that Islam would take root in the favelas of Sao Paulo, because Sao Paulo is the capital or the birthplace of Brazilian hip-hop. And so this link I traced through the book, I traced the association between Islam and hip-hop, right? And in American hip-hop, you've had Islamic influences since the early 70s, starting with Africa Bambaataa in the Bronx, where they set up a movement to counter gang violence. And then you begin to get, in the 80s, Nation of Islam references, and then in the 90s, Sunni references, groups such as Poor Righteous Teachers, Public Enemy, Gangstar, and so on. And when hip-hop goes global in the mid-90s, these references, these allusions are transmitted around the world, inspiring different cultures, inspiring different movements, such as Posse Hausa. But I also look at the relationship between Islam and hip-hop in France and Belgium and Britain and so on. So this is what occurs. And what I argue is that in the 1970s, reggae would disseminate Rastafarianism around the world, right? A number of people would be exposed to Rastafarian thinking and culture through reggae, through 1970s reggae, the music of Bob Marley in particular. In the 80s and 90s, hip-hop would disseminate African-American Islam, right? Hip-hop would broadcast various strands of African-American Islam, 5% or Nation of Islam, Sunni, and so on, around the world, and this would alter cultures and identities elsewhere. And if, I'd say American youth who are not Muslim, or youth around the world who are not Muslim, often hip-hop is their first introduction to Islamic culture, Islamic identity, and references to Islam. Just as for Muslim youth around the world, hip-hop introduces them to Black history and the Black freedom movement. And this leads to all kinds of the cultural intermingling and the political and cultural cross-fertilization that I discuss in the book.
And, it's also very, it's so infused and intertwined with kind of the history of Islam in the West, whether you're talking about when you wrote about what happened in the antebellum South of America or what happens in Brazil, the Muslim slaves. And even though we've not kept up in an established sense this kind of historical tradition, it never really died. And clearly one of the things you're positing is it never really died inside the West. It was always here at some present. It always had this lore for whatever reason, for other complex reasons. So that to me is also an interesting piece you're writing about.
Right. So, you have communities, you have, Muslims who are brought to the Americas, in South America, in the Spanish and Portuguese colonies, Muslim slaves would be brutally repressed and persecuted, right? And the reason for that is that the Portuguese and the Spanish had just won the Reconquista. They had just expelled the Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula, and they did not want the struggle with Islam to continue in the Americas, right? So they made it a point to prevent Muslim slaves from going across, particularly Moorish slaves. In some cases, they would make an exemption for Moriscas. I discuss about the trope of the enchanted Mooress and the Morisca, the role that she plays in Iberian folklore, and how that would also cross the Atlantic. But there was an effort to prevent Muslim slaves from crossing the Atlantic. Exceptions would be made for the Moriscas, who would serve in brothels in the Americas, right? There were a number of cedulas, church decrees, preventing Muslim slaves from going across. But again, exception was made for Moorish women. In North America, there wasn't the same brutality against Muslim slaves. The reason for that is that the English colonialists did not have this long-standing encounter, centuries-old struggle with Islam as the Iberians had. And so you have Muslim slaves appearing in the American South. They too would be forced, to abandon their religion and so on. But they had a little more leeway. And so you get, to this day, you get sort of slave texts that are being discovered, written in Arabic and so on. And what's interesting to me is that nowadays, I look at the pressures on Muslim youth today in the West. And sort of, young Muslim communities are caught between surveillance states on the one hand, right-wing theocratic Muslim movements on the other, and American power on the other. So you're pincered between American power surveillance states and ultra-conservative Muslim movements. Where do you go? Is there a progressive alternative, a progressive outlet for Muslim youth today? One of the things I argue is that the Black Freedom Movement provides such an alternative, right? For Muslim youth today looking for a progressive liberation theology. Many of them are drawn to the Black freedom struggles of the New World, in particular African-American Islam, as represented by Malcolm X. And which is why, you know, I talk about these youth who appear, who come to the Bronx, and, you know, visit some of the, talk to the hip-hop pioneers, and then go up north to visit Malcolm X's grave at a Ferncrest Cemetery in, north of the Bronx.
In all of that, there's this seeming kind of confusion about people from the West and trying to manipulate it all, and how this rise of hip hop among Arab young people, among Muslim young people, that the whole divide between Sufi and Salafi becomes really huge in this war to find who is the real rebel, who is the real spokesperson, whose way of looking at the future in the world is real, between the hip hoppers who became Salafists and Africa Bambaataa, who was brought to France, as you write about, to kind of be this ambassador. I mean, it's a really confusing story.
Mm. Well, you know, the debate over in the 1980s, 1990s, you know, hip hop would transmit these Islamic illusions around the world. And, you know, fertilize French hip-hop and, you know, enrich hip-hop in Brazil and so on. After 9/11, the debate becomes about one about hip-hop, Islam, and radicalization. And the turning point, I believe, was when John Walker Lint, the young American from Marin County, California, was found behind enemy lines in October 2001. He had joined the Taliban, right? He had a number of policymakers and terrorism experts asking, how on earth did this middle-class kid become a jihadi? And eventually they stumbled upon some of his online postings, and they found out that online he used to pose as Black. He referred himself as Professor J. He was a hip-hop head. And the argument was made that a number of these specialists made is that he was radicalized through hip-hop. That actually at the age of 12, his mother took him to see the film Malcolm X, Spike Lee's biopic. After that, he read the autobiography of Malcolm X and introduced him to hip-hop. And hip-hop is what introduced him to what brought him into this radical Islamic internationalism. And he headed east, first to Yemen, and then to Afghanistan. So after that, you begin to hear policymakers saying, we need to respond to this jihadi narrative, because often this narrative is disseminated through music, is disseminated through music videos online, and we need a moderate hip-hop to respond to what Foreign Affairs Journal calls jihadi cool. We need a moderate hip-hop response to them, and we need a moderate understanding of the Malcolm X narrative. And so you begin to get government intervention in hip-hop. Right now, I talk about government efforts to regulate hip-hop in the book. The U.S. government has largely been laissez-faire, hands-off, when it comes to, you know, to hip-hop. The government, U.S., you know, we don't have a Ministry of Culture here. The government does not intervene to regulate, rap. Only time I remember the U.S., you know, the state intervening in hip-hop was, I believe, 1991 with the episode around Two Live Crew, when a local judge, a local court, was going to ban a track by Two Live Crew, and that didn't last long. In Europe, however, the French government has long intervened in music. It has long intervened in culture, and in France, you know, officials openly speak of hip-hop policy, right? And back in the 90s, in 1994, the French government passed a law called the Carignan Law to limit the amount of American rap being played on the French airwaves. Back then, the fear was Americanization, that the more American rap was being played on French radio, the more American words would seep into the French language, words like cool and hip and email,
right,
or whatever,
right,
whatever term it may be. So back then, that's what the French were worried about. After 9/11, and particularly after the riots in 2005, when Sarkozy, when the French government decided that there were seven rap groups that should be put on trial because they had helped inspire the violence, you know, French political elites began speaking about the need to regulate hip-hop. And so they began supporting hip-hoppers deemed moderate against hip-hoppers deemed radical. And this often comes down to sort of a breakdown, as you mentioned, a binary between Sufis and Salafis. And to understand this, you need to look at Muslim debates around music. There's a centuries-old debate with, you know, centuries of opinion about whether music is permitted in Islam or not, right?
Right.
You have the conservatives, most often Salafis, Wahhabis, ultra-conservatives, who argue that music distracts from the worship of God, music is unacceptable, and they'll make an exception for the a cappella singing, devotional chants. On the other hand, the more permissive side, the side that's more supportive of music, tends to be the Sufis, right? Those Sufism known as the mystical branch of Islam. And the Sufis, because they use music for worship, tend to be more tolerant of music. And also, what they argue is that it depends on what you're saying. It depends on the context. It depends on your intent, your niyyah, whether music is permissible or not. So this has long been the debate. And in the last 10, 15 years, as the Salafis have gained power, you have seen music being banned in Afghanistan by the Taliban. You have seen music being banned in Northern Mali, most recently in 2012. By these Salafi jihadist groups that will, you know, disrupt weddings, you know, destroy music stores, destroy CDs, MP3s, and so on. And so after 9/11, for a number of state officials, not just in America, Britain, and not just in the U.S. and in Europe, but also across the Muslim world, from Senegal to Algeria and so on, you have officials beginning to think that a good way to respond to Salafi activism and Salafi intolerance is by mobilizing Sufism, right? By supporting Sufism. So then music after 9/11 becomes a lifestyle criterion, a way to distinguish between a moderate Muslim and a radical Muslim, a good Muslim and a bad Muslim. So that if a kid listens to rap, right, chances are they're moderate. If they don't, chances are they're extremists, right? And this faulty thinking would actually make its way into policy, right? And you have a number of states that begin to support Sufism, and particularly Sufi practice, Sufi music, as a way to disseminate a more liberalist
Islam. Right.
The U.S. would do this for a few years, I would say, from 2003 until 2007 and so. You have other governments. I talk about Pakistan. Great Britain would set up a British Sufi Council. The British Sufi Council would have festivals. And again, the idea was that we need to support Sufism, right, because Sufism is more liberal, more compatible with modernity, more pro-Western, more tolerant. And one way to disseminate Sufi thought is through promotion of music.
I'm talking with Dr. Hisham Aidi. He's the author of a new book called Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. He's a lecturer in international and public affairs at Columbia University and a Carnegie Scholar and Global Fellow at the Open Society Foundation. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
So, we must ask ourselves, what is the dictionary definition of terrorism? The systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and today we're talking with Dr. Hisham Aidi, who wrote the book Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. He's a lecturer in international public affairs at Columbia University, a Carnegie Scholar, and a global fellow at the Open Society Foundation.
With people like Abdel al-Malik in France, and how he has used and how he uses it, and that becomes kind of he's one of the centerpieces here, along with the group you talked about earlier in the book, Kominas from Pakistan, right?
So their trajectory is different. So to begin with Abdel Malik. Abdel Malik is a young French Congolese convert to Islam, and in the early 90s, he grew up in the housing project, the HLM as they're called in France, of Strasbourg. He dabbles in gangster rap. He is quite popular with his group called the New African Poets. And then he decides that, you know, enough of this rap style, right? Which is a common trajectory. Enough with the hip hop lifestyle, with the rap lifestyle. And he joins the Jamaat Tablighi, which is an Islamist group of South Asian origin. Stops doing hip hop, becomes an Islamist, and then he has another conversion, and he becomes a Sufi. And once he becomes a Sufi, he goes back to making music, but this time instead of rap, instead of hip hop, instead of the hard hitting lyrics that he had in the 90s, today it's largely sort of spoken word poetry with chanson française rhythms and jazz riffs, right? And he has an enormous amount of success with this, and he becomes probably the most celebrated rapper in France of the last decade. Right? The French cultural establishment has bestowed every kind of honor on Abdelmalik, given him, you know, he's been invited to the presidential palace, and so on. And he's a great artist. He's very articulate. He says, we French hip-hop artists, we are the children of Chuck D and Derrida. Right? This is a, you know, he's a Sorbonne. He studied at the Sorbonne. And what I say is that he's a tremendous artist, but when the French state embraced him, right, he would lose a lot of his street credibility. He would lose his credibility within the hip-hop community. Now, why did the French government embrace him? Because they saw him as a moderate alternative to some of the more hard-hitting rap coming out of the French banlieue, the French ghetto. And in particular, they saw him as a moderate alternative to Medine, who is a French-Algerian rapper with a fierce beard, who is a Black Power-inspired rapper. So if Abdelmalik talks about how he loves France and how the secular republic's values of liberté, égalité, and so on are entirely compatible with Islam, and that there will be no racial conflict in France, there will be no race wars in France, Abdelmalik talks about everything that, Medine talks about everything that Abdelmalik avoids. He talks about empire, he talks about the legacies of French colonialism, he talks about discrimination, he talks about urban exclusion, how African and Muslim youth live today, the conditions they live in France today. And in France, the French government has come to see Abdelmalik as an alternative, right? Because they see the music that he represents and the Islam that he represents as the kind of Islam that can be let into the public sphere in France. While the rap that's put forth by Medine or Kerry James is more militant, more radical, and, causes anxiety. Now, to talk about the Cominas. The Cominas are sort of a trio, three Pakistani-American punk rockers from the Boston area. They're interesting to me because they emerged in the early 2000s partly to contest conservative Muslim attitude towards music within America, within the American Muslim community, right? So they'd go to the Islamic ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, their annual convention. They'd play their music there. They'd sing all kinds of raunchy songs and get thrown out of the convention. But then they turned their attention towards American and British Sufi policy, this business of mobilizing Sufism as a way to deal with Islamic extremism, right? And they travel back and forth between Boston and Lahore. Their lyrics, you know, they draw on punk. They do a lot of punk rock mixed with raps. They draw on early African American Islam, which is very interesting. They sort of, you know, draw on the ideas of Noble Drew Ali, who founded the Moorish Science Temple. And they also draw on 18th century Sufi poets, some of the great Sufi poets of South Asia, figures such as Bule Shah, but also Al-Rumi. And when they would protest, right, when they became more political towards the mid-2000s, is how the British government and the American government, and in particular Musharraf, right, began using Sufism and Sufi poetry as a way to respond to Islamic extremism, right, as a way to respond to the Taliban. So to them, this was outrageous. Given that Musharraf, this is a man who suspends the Constitution, given that this is a leader with authoritarian tendencies, and what they would protest is this idea of government instrumentalizing of Sufism, right? And what Basim, who's the lead vocalist for the group, who also writes a column for The Guardian, he would say, Sufis have paid a dear price, right? A very high price. For their embrace by the Pakistani government, right? Because as soon as the Pakistani government embraces them as good Muslims, moderate Muslims, to be mobilized against the extremists, and they become a target. The Sufis become a target, right? And this whole notion that, and what they would argue also, that this whole idea that, you know, all you have to do is unleash music and unleash Sufi poetry, and that'll, you know, that'll calm things down. Well, it's pretty simplistic, right? It ignores policy, right? And this comes back to the debate, which is taking place within the American foreign policy establishment, within the Muslim community. What are the roots of Islamic extremism, or what are the roots of the political violence that comes out of these Salafi Shahadi circles? So on the one hand, you have people, sort of left-leaning people, such as the Khomeinis and the realists, who argue that jihadist violence is a response to policy, right? It's in response to some American policy or set of policies, the so-called blowback argument. And the solution here would be to scale back America's presence. So that's one camp. The other camp are people who argue, no, that this is actually, the jihadist violence is actually a product of a certain narrative, right? A narrative, a theology, an ideology, a culture, right? And their solution is that to respond to this narrative, you need to have a public diplomacy that puts forth a moderate Islam, a different narrative. Right? You understand where I'm going with this?
Yes.
Right. So, this is the debate that would play out, you know, between Muslim musicians, right? So that, one of the points I make is that the Khomeinis were responding to Musharraf. They were also responding to one of the first rock groups to come out of Pakistan, one of the most prominent rock groups in Pakistan, Junoon. And Salman Ahmed, who very prominently believes also that the response to Islamic extremism is the guitar. It's music, and music will convey a new discourse. What the Khomeinis say is, what about state policy, right? As long as you have, you know, Musharraf suspending the constitution and letting drones fall on Pakistan and so on, you can play all the music you want. It's not going to change attitudes. So this is an ongoing debate, and it's playing out, as I said, within policy circles, within the Muslim community, and within academia as well.
And it plays out throughout the book within this story. It plays out between those rappers who have, and we can talk about a couple of them, who have walked away from hip-hop, become Salafi preachers,
right,
and poets, yeah. Right?
Right, absolutely. So, you know, the interaction between Islam and hip-hop is complex and dynamic and changing. So, as I said, in the 90s, you have youth, sort of American youth, being exposed to Islam through hip-hop and then embracing hip-hop, right? I mentioned Everlast, an American rapper who embraces Islam, and he's exposed to this religion through music. On the other hand, you have former rappers, or, you know, rappers who through hip-hop are exposed to the world of Islam, and they decide that, you know what, I agree with the conservative argument that music takes away from the worship of God. And, you know, when I talk about how the Muslim conservatives will criticize music, but they'll often single out hip-hop, right, for criticism because of some of, you know, because of the excesses, the consumerism, the materialism, the misogyny, and that you have in some videos and lyrics and so on. And so you have a number of rappers who would leave hip-hop altogether and become Salafi preachers, Salafi evangelists. And I give the example there of Napoleon, who was part of Tupac Shakur's posse. And he has a conversion at one point and decides that, you know what, he's going to give up hip-hop. And he becomes Mutabil Shabazz, right? That's the new name he adopts. And now he travels the world speaking out against the excesses of hip-hop, right? And telling youth, you know, this culture is distracting you from God. This culture is not, you know, not taking you in a positive direction. Right? And so this is the debate taking place within the Muslim community around hip-hop.
So there's some pieces I really do want to explore before we run out of time, because I think that it's kind of winding back to history and back again. And because you also make this interesting, there's so much stuff here, and I need another whole day here to think about this and kind of try to put some of these pieces together. But the connection between the African American world of jazz,
mm-hmm.
and the relationship you write about it with so many of the artists, Yusuf Tief and so many more, who became Muslims. At the same time, America is using jazz as the ambassador to counter the Soviet Union. And you,
that's right.
And you write about the African-American artists becoming, and if I say this wrong, you'll correct my pronunciation, Ganawa, right?
Right. Yeah, you say it perfectly.
So and Ganawa, and my dear friend Bob Wisdom, who's an actor and a musician, goes to the Ganawa Festival every year in Morocco.
I should hook up with him. I'm always there.
Oh, he's amazing. Bob is an amazing guy in terms of music and spirituality and politics. But anyway, so talk a bit about that juxtaposition I just raised to you, because that's part of the roots of all this, even though it's not hip-hop.
Right. So the encounter between jazz and Islam foreshadows in some ways the encounter between hip-hop and Islam. And in terms of jazz, you know, Eric Hobsbawm, the late British historian.
And I never knew that, by the way, as this interruption. When I read that in your book, I never connected him with any of this. But then I said,
well,
it made sense.
He was a jazz critic on the side.
Right.
Writing under the name of Francis Newton. He was one of the first to note the complex relationship of jazz and Islam. Right. And he would argue that the expansion of jazz around the world, the dissemination of jazz around the world, recalls the expansion of Islam. Right, so that type of rapid expansion. And another connection that he'd make was that he'd noticed the role of Islam within the jazz world, right? How, he said, a number of jazz musicians were being drawn to these ideologies of third world solidarity in the 40s and 50s. Right? And he would talk about that and talk about Dizzy Gillespie's ideas about this and how a number of jazz musicians would embrace Islam. And so I detail this in the book. And what I say is that with the Great Migration, as a number of, as you get millions of African Americans migrating northward, they settled in American cities. And these American inner cities in the 40s and 50s were very rich, exciting cultural areas where you had, people coming in from South Asia and the Middle East and Africa and bringing their, their ideas about decolonization and Afro-Asian solidarity and Bandung, just as there were a number of African-American movements that were Muslim or quasi-Muslim. And these jazz musicians would be attracted to these ideas and ideologies simply because they saw a parallel between the African-American struggle for self-determination, for freedom, and the colonized world's struggle for independence. And many would begin to go traveling overseas. I mentioned the case of Art Blakey, who would go to West Africa. And then he'd come back and he would set up the Jazz Messengers. The Messengers, called initially, a 17-member, all-Muslim band based here in Harlem and associated with the Ahmadi Mosque that was based here in Harlem. And so that was the beginning, right? That's one of the earliest moments where you see sort of the influence of Islam and jazz. But then I talk about people such as Yusuf Lateef. I mean, a number of artists, Ahmed Jamal, Yusuf Lateef, McCoy Tyner. Ebony Magazine would have a story about this. About why are these jazz musicians turning towards Islam, and Dizzy Gillespie writes about this in his memoir as well. His book is called "To Be or Not to Box," right? And he talks about how embracing Islam in some ways not only connected you with you go from being a minority to being part of a global majority, but also domestically it allowed you to transcend some racial barriers. And what's interesting to me is that the music that these artists would create, Yusuf Lateef would almost single-handedly create a genre, what's known as world music jazz. I interviewed him a number of times. He was very gracious, a very brilliant man. And again, he traveled. He went everywhere from northern Nigeria to Pakistan, and he would incorporate the rhythms of these countries into his art, into his music. And what he told me is that, as a child who moved up from Chattanooga, Tennessee to Detroit, living in Paradise Valley, he would walk around the Syrian market. Back then, this is when you had Syrian and Yemeni immigrants, Arab immigrants coming to work in the car industry in Detroit. Walking around the Syrian market, he would pick up the instruments from places such as Palestine and Syria and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. He would incorporate them into his repertoire. And so jazz goes global after World War One, right? The Harlem Renaissance spreads to France. It was actually African-American troops, the Harlem James Reesherp was a band leader from here in Harlem who would introduce jazz to France, right, and spark a cultural craze in France. So jazz spreads to France, and then eventually it percolates downwards to the colonies in North Africa and West Africa. And you get a number of these jazz artists in the 40s and 50s who begin touring, Dizzy Gillespie and so on. So they'd go on their own and they travel Europe and Africa, but also the State Department in 1955 decides that jazz is a good way to respond to Soviet propaganda about American racialism, right? So the Soviets, the way they were wooing, they were courting newly independent states in Africa and Asia was by saying that Russia is better on race than America, right? And they would, you know, they would play, you know, the images of racial strife in the American South, broadcasting images of the death of Emmett, the murder of Emmett Till, and the U.S. government decided that a good way to respond would be through jazz, right? By sending out these integrated bands led by the likes of Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong and so on, and jazz would represent, you know, in the view of State Department planners, the inclusiveness of American democracy, the diversity of American democracy, and in general, sort of the transcendent nature of American identity. And so these jazz bands would perform everywhere from Northwest Africa, across North Africa, the Middle East, and behind the Iron Curtain, right? They would perform in Yugoslavia, they perform in Russia, they perform in East Germany. And what I discuss is that, you know, some of the tensions here, obviously, you had left-leaning artists such as Dizzy Gillespie being sent out to represent the U.S. You had artists with Muslim sympathies being sent out to represent the U.S. And also, after the tours end, a number of these artists would settle overseas, right? So the late pianist Dave Brubeck, you know, would take a very strong interest in Turkish music. And that would partly inspire Rondo Alaturk. Randy Weston, the pianist, Brooklyn-born pianist, would take an interest in the Gnawa music of North Africa, right? So Randy decides to settle in Tangier, Morocco, which was one of where the VOA was based, Voice of America, a relay station that was broadcasting these jazz programs across, you know, the Soviet bloc. They were based actually in Tangier, Morocco. And that's where Randy Weston decides to settle. And he takes an interest in local Gnawa music, and he connects with a local artist named Abdullah Gurd. And I talk about their relationship in the book, right? So Gnawa music in North Africa after independence was marginalized, right? Most Sufi music was marginalized. Why? Because French colonialism had sought to mobilize Sufi practice, Sufi culture, Sufi music, seeing it as indigenous and moderate as a way, again, to distance North Africa from the Middle East and the larger Islamic world, right? So the French have long had a very keen interest in Sufism and Sufi hysteria and people trancing and so on. And that was policies through the 20s and 30s. As independence movements began to emerge in North Africa, they wanted to celebrate a different kind of music, right? The Arab-Muslim repertoire of Andalusia, of Islamic Spain. That's what binds North Africa together. That's what binds North Africa with the wider Arab world, and then even beyond that, the Islamic world. So when these governments gain independence in the 50s and early 60s, they marginalize Sufi music, right? Different practices, different Sufi orders, Gnawa, Ahmadiyya, Isawa, and so on. And they would celebrate the Arab repertoire of Andalusia, making that our classical music, the classical music of North Africa. And what happens in the 60s and 70s is that all the excluded musics, all the excluded communities begin pushing back against the hegemony of Andalusian music. And the role of the jazz musicians here is critical, because it is the jazz musicians in taking an interest in Gnawa music who would bring Gnawa music out of the margins. So Randy Weston would embrace his music, begin collaborating. He and his son Niles would join different groups. And they play, and then they organize the Pan-African Festival celebrating the music along with jazz. This is the Pan-African Festival of Tangier, which took place a couple of years after the Pan-African Festival of Algiers in 1969. And then Randy Weston would, you know, take that music to Europe. And he and his Moroccan collaborator, El Gourd, would play in different concert halls, but also neighborhoods. You know, this is as North African immigration was increasing in Europe, so they'd play in different, you know, community centers and so on. And eventually, you know, now when music would become popular in Europe, it would become popular among jazz musicians in America. You have other artists following suit. You have Pharoah Sanders, Archie Shepp, and so on, going to Morocco, trying to find local collaborators. Even Yusuf Lateef would incorporate the Gnawa Sinti of the instrument into the music. And so I discussed the debate around this music. I mean, this music is used for healing. This is a music that's, you know, used, you know, to deal with the jinn, with the spirits. When the spirit possesses someone, someone is mentally ill. This is the music that you play to heal them, to reconcile the jinn, the spirit with the sick individual. And so I talk about the debate about as this music became popular, right, in the West, it would boomerang back to North Africa and would become popular at home. The government will sponsor a festival, annual Gnawa Festival. And every year, you know, there's this question that comes up that how did this music, Gnawa music, become the most well-known music of Morocco? How did this happen? This is the music that tourists like. How did we embrace the music? And another dimension to this, of course, is that the North African youth, Muslim youth growing up in Europe, love this music as well, right? It is a music that connects them to the Caribbean, to the Pan-African, it connects them to Africa, the Caribbean, the Pan-African world. It is a music that gives them an entry into the Black Freedom Movement that they're drawn to. And so the trajectory of this music is fascinating, right? And the first people to take an interest, the first Westerners to take an interest in Gnawa music were jazz age figures, right? Musicians and artists. And I mentioned the case of Claude McKay, who was a Harlem Renaissance poet, mm-hmm. novelist, author of Banjo, you know, born in the West Indies, Jamaica, come to the U.S., and then moved to Europe and then settled in North Africa. Right? It begins in the Harlem Renaissance. And so the popularity of this music today is a very interesting example of how relations between Islam and the West create certain cultures and elevate certain cultures.
So I'm going to bring it back around. You begin your sojourn, you know, discovering, you begin the sojourn discovering the Muslim kids from around the world making pilgrimages to Harlem and the Bronx and to come into the Mecca of hip-hop, as you write about. And you take us to Brazil. And I'm curious where you think, given the push by the West to kind of manipulate and use hip-hop on one way and the fact that this has become the music of resistance. I mean, the one place I've been familiar with is kind of looking at the hip hop that's come out of Egypt and Palestine, and kind of as a music of resistance for a lot of people, a lot of young people. So, and taking that, and so I wonder, you know, what you think to take this book beyond the last chapter. Where do you take it now? You know, where do you what do you think is the future of this?
Well, look, hip hop is the global lingua franca of youth, right? It's the lingua franca of youth around the world, right? It's the dominant youth culture. It's attractive to youth around the world for various reasons. It's in and of itself, you know, the art form is massively compelling, but also it represents protest. At least, you know, hip hop of the 1990s. And to Muslim youth, it's attractive because of all the Islamic influences that you see in hip-hop, right, starting in the 70s. And that is why it's being mobilized for protests everywhere from, you know, the outskirts of Berlin to Pakistan to Senegal. And it is because of the resonance of hip-hop among Muslim youth that government officials want to use it. If you read State Department reports about, you know, American public diplomacy towards the Muslim world and so on, they speak of hip-hop as a natural connector to Muslim youth because it represents a long tradition of African-American protest as epitomized by Malcolm X, right? So, and this has led to a debate, right? So in Europe, you have artists such as Low Key, right, who is an anarchist, hard-left rapper, speaks about imperialism and racism and U.S. foreign policy, wildly popular among Muslim youth, but still generally an underground figure. And he says, you know, regarding American efforts to mobilize hip-hop, he says, what does it mean when the White House likes the same rappers that you do?
Right.
He's referring, he's referring to Jay-Z. He's referring to Jay-Z being up, you know, at Obama's inauguration.
Right.
You know, what does that mean? And he asks, what is hip-hop? You know, what is the purpose of hip-hop? Is it about speaking truth to power? Is it about struggle? Or is it the soundtrack of American empire? I think, you know, these soft power initiatives can be successful when they align well with hard power. For instance, if you're sending artists to perform in Bahrain, where there is an uprising, and the U.S. government is backing the government that's cracking down on the uprising, I don't think such initiatives will work, because people can see that, you know, the U.S. government is acting in two contradictory ways. In fact, it may create more ill will. Likewise, sending artists to perform, Muslim hip-hop artists to perform in Pakistan while there are drone strikes being ordered against that country, probably will not work. However, in Europe, where European Muslims are not living under American-backed authoritarian regimes, such initiatives may succeed in improving perceptions of the United States. For instance, the U.S. Embassy in Paris is reaching out to artists, you know, hip-hop artists who are being harassed by the French government, giving them, you know, assistance, inviting them to perform at the embassy or inviting them for tours of the United States. That actually can create positive impressions and can actually improve the image of the U.S.
Whether that kind of legacy from blues to jazz to hip-hop, I was thinking about this after going through your book that, I mean, the world of African American music and art and culture, in many ways, oppressed cultures around the globe have always identified with that as kind of a culture of resistance.
Right. I mean, yeah, the book, you know, I'm talking about global black cultural production, right?
Right.
Black cultural,
right.
Black American cultural production at a global level. And, you know, what's very interesting is that sort of America today sees black culture as probably one of its greatest sources of soft power, right? And there is a deployment of black culture, but not simply of black music, jazz, and hip-hop and so on, but also of the civil rights movement, right? Efforts to deploy the symbolic and moral capital of the civil rights movement, efforts to impart American racial common sense, so to speak, right? Going and holding workshops and conferences on affirmative action in France, on race classification in Germany, and so on, trying to impart, you know, the civil rights movement and the American integration model to European states. So it is culture on the one hand. It certainly is. I mean, American culture, African American culture, has inspired movements, transformed identities around the world, and it is being harnessed by U.S. governments to improve the country's image, to combat poor perceptions. But it goes beyond music, right? It's sort of the language of American primacy today is one that speaks of diversity and racial integration and civil rights movements.
Well, this has been fascinating. Your book is fascinating. I look forward to doing many more conversations in the future with you, Hisham.
Sure.
Hisham Aidi, his book is Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. And thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care, Mark.
Right. Bye-bye. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.